Thank you for tuning in to Buffalo Means Business on News Radio 930 WBEN. I'm Randy Bushover. The program highlights local businesses and services in the region, and if there's a local business or service you'd like to hear from, send me an email at randy.bushover@entercom.com. With me, a pair of directors from Freedmaxic CPAs, Tim McPoland and Joe Aquino. Gentlemen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Randy.
Thanks for having us.
Among the areas that you guys work within, fraud investigations, forensic accounting, how does that work exactly, fraud investigations? What sort of thing is it that you actually do?
So typically we get called in when there's been a potential embezzlement within a organization, white-collar crime, and determine the amount of money that was stolen.
And how exactly do you go through that process? Does someone come to you and say, hey, I think we have a problem, or do you actually do all of the work to find that there is a problem and then go kind of backtrack it?
Usually we get called from the owner of the business or their attorney, and they feel that they've uncovered some impropriety within the organization, and they want us to come in and determine if, what is the extent of the crime.
I guess I should go back and also establish that you guys have more than just the office here in Buffalo. You guys are pretty widespread.
Yes, we have approximately 300 employees. We're headquartered down in Buffalo in the Liberty Building. We've been there since 1958. We're celebrating 60 years in business, which is a great accomplishment we're very proud of. And we also have an office in Batavia, Rochester, and Syracuse.
All right. And Joe, we haven't heard from you yet, so explain what it is that you do for Freedmaxic CPAs.
I'm a director both in the audit and accounting, but I also work in our business valuation litigation support group. So what that means is Tim and I typically, if it's working with attorneys or in situations where there's shareholder disputes, issues between shareholders, where they can't necessarily come to an agreement on the value of the company, we're brought in to kind of help with that process. So evaluation's needed because what they're trying to do is settle that financial transaction with the affected shareholder, and they can't come to an agreement on what the actual value of that ownership in the company is worth.
All right, Tim, what are the typical fraud scenarios that you've seen or worked on?
So most of the cases are really not that complicated. Typically, you've got a bookkeeper or controller who is very involved in the business. There's a lack of segregation of duties, and typically we see is cash payments out to that individual, or payments to fictitious vendors, or stealing cash before it gets recorded in the on the books and records. So most of them are not very complicated, but it's determining, when did the crime start, what were the type of schemes, because typically there may be multiple schemes that are involved, not just paying their personal corporate credit card with corporate funds. So it's multiple different types of scenarios that you will see.
And just to reset, how exactly are these frauds, probably not the proper word, but how are they discovered, uncovered?
Typically, it's by accident. Over 50% is either the bookkeeper controller is on vacation or out sick, and an accounting question comes up, and the owner or some of the other employees start to look for the answer, and all of a sudden they uncover something that looks not right, and that's typically when we get involved in. Or you may get a call from a vendor or from a charge card company, Visa or Amex, says, hey, we're noticing that this individual's monthly credit card is being paid by corporate funds. Are you guys aware of that? So many times it's just by a hot tip or just, by accident.
Talking to Tim McPoland and Joe Aquino, both directors for Freedmaxic CPAs. And Joe, I want to turn to you for the business valuation part of things. So what type of scenarios do you typically see business valuations used for when it comes to litigation?
Sure. I'd say the most common, Randy, is when there's issues between shareholders. We'll see either there's a shareholder buyout or a dissenting shareholder that's not happy with the situation and wants out, and they can't come to an agreement on price. So what the valuation does is it determines a price that can be used to kind of settle that transaction for the affected shareholder.
And that's, of course, very interesting. What is the process once the situation is identified and you've brought it into the situation?
So when the parties can't agree, what they'll do is, and the parties can be either existing shareholders with the company. It could be if the shareholder dies, there's a dispute with that shareholder's estate where they can't come to an agreement on price. So the process typically is with the parties. They'll both hire an independent appraiser to do a valuation. And once those evaluations are done, if they still can't come to an agreement, then a lot of times it will end up in court where the valuator ends up being an expert witness to defend their report in front of a judge or jury. The process itself can get pretty complicated in that we're looking at several years of historical or projected financial information, trying to analyze the historical trends of the company. What does the operations look like over the last few years? What is it projected to look like over the next few years? Are there anomalies included, meaning are there things that maybe are one-offs that might affect the value of the company? Are there things that aren't comparable to the market or to other companies in that industry that the company we're valuing is involved in? And it's looking at, is owner's compensation excessive? Are there family members included on the payroll or other non-operating type expenses? Are there one-time hits that might, you know, help or hurt the value of that company that we're trying to normalize an earnings stream to come up with a fair market value?
And just to add on to that, Joe, I mean, business valuation isn't so much an exact science. So you can get five valuators in a room, they'll come up with five different valuations, but there's, you know, over the years, there's much more empirical data, there's much more transactional data out there that you can pull from to support a valuation of a business.
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys about that, because that seems like that would be one of the hardest things to do, is to figure out, you know, based on, first of all, what product or service that the business is offering, and that's going to maybe change depending on market value of that particular product, right?
Right, exactly. And in today's environment, I mean, the multiples that are being paid for businesses is extraordinary, you know, but we have to look at, you know, empirical data, look at rates of return in the marketplace, and what would a willing buyer and a willing seller pay for that business? And you're looking at ultimately the cash flow from the operations. You know, how good is the cash flow and how consistent will that be to pay back, you know, the return on the dollars that are being invested in the business?
And that's why you want to normalize it too, because a lot of times there could be things that happened in the past that aren't necessarily going to be reflective of what's happening in the future that could impact the overall value for that company.
And Joe, as you and Tim just talked about, that's a pretty involved amount of information there. What can business owners put in place to prevent the need for all of this?
Yep, it can be pretty extensive as well as expensive for the business owner. So one of the recommendations is to have a solid buy-sell agreement in place. You know, I think a lot of times business owners aren't necessarily focused on that aspect, or rightfully so, or obviously focused on the day-to-day operations of running their business. And especially if things are going well, then they're not really worried about what's going to happen if things aren't going so well. And so a solid buy-sell agreement will help in kind of laying out the process that the company will use if any of these shareholder situations arise, such as, you know, the death of a shareholder or the disability of a shareholder where he can't work or she can't work anymore, or just the case if a shareholder no longer wants to be an owner in the company. It'll not only help with the process, but it'll lay out how the value of that company is going to be determined. It could be a specific formula that the company uses, or it could be just a reference to using an independent appraiser such as Tim and I. It helps not only because a lot of times in reality what we've seen is even when a buy-sell agreement is in place, it's not reviewed or updated all that often, and it hasn't been looked at since it was even created. So the value or the formula that's being used isn't updated or current with the operations of the company, and you have disputes between shareholders because they can't agree on the value. So if it's updated periodically, whether it's every year, whether it's every couple years, everybody's more in line with that value and the methodologies that are being used, and it just helps alleviate issues in the future.
Tim, if we could shift back to the fraud investigations portion, and how do you perform an investigation? What are the key elements to that?
Well, the key elements is, when you suspect something is happening, an impropriety, is to secure documentation, secure bank records, secure information systems, the computer records for the potential perpetrator. Because there has to be some form of reconnaissance. You may pick up on a tip that, you know, there's some impropriety going on, so you may have to spend nights and weekends pulling records together. And so what you want to do is you want to build your case before the perpetrator knows that something is going on. And so when you eventually address the perpetrator with the evidence that you do have, it's a lot stronger case than if the perpetrator thinks that you're starting to investigate something. Then you start destroying records, and it makes your case a lot harder to try and develop against that particular individual.
And I would imagine that would make that even more difficult to resolve then, if you are in fact having records destroyed and then trying to figure out a way to either get those back electronically or by some other method.
Yeah, absolutely, because banks typically after 5 or 7 years destroy bank records. So, I mean, the typical embezzlement lasts, 4 to 5 years. We've been involved with some that go back as long as 25 years. So in order to prove the amount of money that was taken, you have to have access to all the records as far back as that individual started working for the company.
And even though the two of you, Tim and Joe, kind of work different ends of things, I would imagine there are a number of times where both of your cases kind of come together, right? Where you've got some fraud involved along with the business valuation, because those two would be intertwined, perhaps.
Yeah, if you start looking at on the valuation side, where there may be money going out the back door for potentially a third party that maybe the owner is also involved in, and so you've got money being siphoned out to that third party vendor, and that was a way for that individual to take additional money out of the business, and there's no really services being performed. So obviously in Joe's situation, you would possibly uncover that and then treat that as an add back or a normalization adjustment, because the profits of the company were artificially deflated because this person was actually siphoning money off through another company.
And do either of you know, is there such a thing as knowing how prevalent this is now as compared to years past? Are we seeing about the same amount of the fraud and that sort of thing, or is there less?
With the advent of the casinos and the buildup of casinos, because people don't steal money to hoard it and stick it underneath their mattress. There's usually a need why they're stealing the money, and gambling is the number one reason out there. I've worked on a number of cases with the district attorney's office. I started probably 20 years ago, and the average embezzlement was $20,000 to $30,000. Now it's $200,000 to $300,000. So there is a need out there. Casinos are probably the biggest reason. Lifestyle changes. People like to keep up with the Joneses, and you've got somebody making $60,000 a year but drives around in expensive cars, goes on lavish vacations, puts their kids through, expensive colleges. So I always tell everybody a lot of the clues are very visual. You can start to see 1 plus 1 doesn't add up to 2. Their lifestyle exceeds what they're getting paid. So it makes it for interesting investigations.
And Joe, anything to follow up on with that?
Yeah, and I think, and Tim can elaborate more, I think, but initially, too, as you start to uncover the fraud and the dollars start to add up, it's never initially what they think. They'll estimate one number, and once, all the fraud work is done, it could be a significant amount more that actually ends up being embezzled. So, I think if they start to understand that there's a situation, and a lot of times it doesn't come to light, or they don't want it to come to light and think they can handle it on their own, then the amount of the loss is actually significantly amount more once we get in and start doing the work.
And unfortunately, generally, there's no restitution there. Very seldom you'll get any kind of restitution. So,
well, gentlemen, learned a lot, and know that I just scratched the surface on both topics. So thank you for enlightening us on what you did so far.
Thanks.
Thank you, Randy.
Those are directors Tim McPoland and Joe Aquino with Freed Maxick CPAs. This is Buffalo Means Business on News Radio 930 WBEN.